I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Certainly one of the most captivating public figures on the planet, Pope Francis tweets. He eschews opulence. He admonishes bishops to be more pastoral. He speaks off the cuff at times, and he seems to question Catholic doctrine. He's likely the first pope anyone called cool. Liberal in actions and attitude, yet conservative in what he ultimately says about church teaching, Francis comes to the U.S. next week. He will be the first pope to address Congress, and observers expect him to speak about racial injustice and income inequality. Ahead of the papal visit, a talk about the Francis pontificate on Midday with, among others, British journalist Paul Vallely, who's written extensively about Pope Francis and sees his papacy as a struggle for the soul of Catholicism. Midday on Pope Francis, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Next Tuesday, 1 week from today, Pope Francis travels from Cuba to Washington, D.C. for a five-day visit, his first trip ever to the U.S. The Pope will meet with President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as American bishops. Francis will also become the first pope to address Congress. Francis is not the first pope to come to the U.S. Pope Benedict, now the Pope Emeritus, visited the U.S. in 2008, and Pope John Paul II made the trek seven times, one of those to Baltimore and Camden Yards, memorably, in 1995. His last visit was 1999. Pope Francis's visit is expected to draw millions of visitors, both the faithful and those captivated by his star power. The 10,000 tickets released for the Pope's address at Independence Hall in Philadelphia were all reserved in 2 minutes. Another set of 10,000 tickets for a mass on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway up there were snapped up in just 30 seconds. Today, ahead of this historic visit, a survey of Pope Francis and the Catholic Church will cover his recent remarks on abortion, annulment, and economic inequality, and how his remarks about modern throwaway culture are related to both the environment and Europe's refugee crisis. We start today's show with British journalist Paul Vallely. He is the author of the best-selling biography, Pope Francis, Untying the Knots, and now its sequel, Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism, published this month by Bloomsbury. Paul Vallely, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Paul, this is the third year of the Francis pontificate, and American Catholics that I speak to, including this one, still wondering, trying to figure this pope out a little bit. You know, you say in the introduction to your book that asking the question, is he liberal, is he conservative, is the wrong question. But let's examine that a little bit.
Sure. He is conservative in the sense that he holds to the orthodox teaching of the church. He's not in any way changed anything on major doctrines. And yet he has disconcerted conservatives by being quite revolutionary in the way that he approaches these same issues. He's changed the tone, not the substance. He wants the church to be compassionate, welcoming, merciful, rather than setting out rules and making judgments, being condemnatory. So that's quite a paradigm shift.
To use the word radical to describe Francis is okay as long as it's used relative to other popes, right? So radical can be applied here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when people talk about liberal and conservative, they tend to think about political issues. And in the United States, particularly, they're looking at culture wars issues like abortion, gay marriage, and so forth. But there are several fault lines, as it were, within the Catholic Church. One is that political one, which we borrow from secular politics. But there's also another dividing line, and that's between people who want the church to be centralized and people who want it to be out there in the regions. And you've got some people who are quite traditional and orthodox in their theology, like, say, Cardinal Pell, the Australian cardinal, who Francis has brought in to shake up the finances at the Vatican Bank and elsewhere. But he's one of the people who feels that the church shouldn't be centralized. And one of the things that's key to understanding Francis, if you look at the eight cardinals, the nine cardinals now that he's got on his council of advisors, they're all people who think that the church has been too centralized, and the Vatican has been too much of a master to the church rather than its servant. So that's a second fault line. And then there's a third fault line, which is to do with the way worship is conducted. And some people like, you know, the traditional ways, the Latin Mass, the plain chant and so forth. And others want more modern ways of worshipping. In the past, it was assumed that conservatives were traditional on worship and were centralizers. But now what we're seeing with this pope is that those three categories, those three axes, are dividing, and you're seeing different plays between many factions in the church.
So one of the things that's going on that's perhaps harder for the layman to see is what's going on in the Vatican in terms of the bureaucracy, the church's bureaucracy.
Yes, the bureaucracy is something which was widely perceived to be dysfunctional under the previous pope. Pope Benedict was a gentle scholar. He wasn't interested in administration and organization, and he really let things take their own course. So what you got was lots of different factions within the Vatican, each involved in a kind of turf war, protecting their own patch and trying to make sure that nobody else had control of what they did and their budgets and so forth. That kind of dysfunction in the Vatican was something that a lot of cardinals, when it came to be electing a new pope after Benedict resigned, thought was really important. And the man who was Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires then, was someone who had a good track record on administration and dealing with financial scandals. So he was the obvious man to put in to sort out that kind of mess.
He was a leader of Argentina's Jesuits. And being a Jesuit, I think, you know, some people still, Paul, find this remarkable that a Jesuit is the pope. Catholics.
Yes, Jesuits are not supposed to be pope.
No.
Jesuits take a vow which says that they won't seek high office in the church.
Right. And, you know, they bring to intellectual discourse generally liberalizing ideas and passions. And a lot of Americans are still sort of surprised that this even happened to begin with. So I guess I'm asking you, because this is the first time we've spoken, to go back with me for 3 years to his election as pope and just explain that to me. Some people, I'm serious. Some people still wonder how did Jorge Mario Bergoglio become pope?
Well, he was the leader of the Jesuits. The Jesuits are not all liberals. A lot of Jesuits are conservatives, but they're all intellectuals and they're all free thinkers, and they come at problems from first principles. When he was the leader of the Jesuits in Argentina, this is 20 years ago, he was quite a divisive figure. He was more on the conservative side then. He was very authoritarian, and when he became pope, he gave an interview saying that he really screwed up when he was leader of the Jesuits. He made hundreds of errors because he was too authoritarian, and people thought he was ultra-conservative as a result of that. So that was the background from which he came. But what happened after 20 years in the Jesuits, he became a bishop, an ordinary bishop, and he was a bishop and then an archbishop in Buenos Aires for 20 years. And in those 20 years, he spent a lot of time in the slums. One of the slum priests told me that he half the people in slum, about 10,000 people in this particular slum, had met Bergoglio personally, because he spent so much time there wandering around the streets and blessing the children and drinking tea with people and so forth. So he came to the papacy as somebody who had got this Jesuit background, but had been very much tempered by being an ordinary priest, living with real people in messy situations, and he understood that lived experience isn't, you know, the same as the ideals that the theology books would set out. So he'd got these two different backgrounds. When he was up for election, the cardinals knew that they needed to sort out the mess in the Vatican bureaucracy. They needed to sort out the mess in the Vatican Bank, which was scandal ridden and full of accusations of money laundering and various other things. And they needed somebody who was going to take the message of the church out into the world in a different kind of way. And when you have an election for pope, it's preceded by several days of discussing what kind of pope we need. You don't mention names, but you say, what kind of person do we need? And Bergoglio himself stood up in that meeting and he said, we need someone who's going to take the message of the church out. We need somebody who will be going out to the peripheries, geographically and existentially. We need somebody who's not looking at a church which is self-referential, as he calls it, focused in on itself, but getting the message out of the sacristy and into the streets. And when he sat down after he'd made this speech, one cardinal turned to the man next to him and said, this is the man we need. And that was the kind of third element of why he was made pope.
But the message could not be the same one. It could not be the same delivered by John Paul or by his successor.
Well, different popes put emphasis in different places. But if you look at, say, the subject which has got this pope into most hot water in the United States, his views on capitalism and how the present economic system is geared in such a way that the people at the bottom of the heap never really get out of being at the bottom. What he says is very similar to what John Paul II said and Benedict XVI. He says it with more emphasis. He says it with more ferocity. And because he's the first pope ever from the global south, he has a different perspective. He sees the world from the bottom up, not from the top down. Mm-hmm. And he says things like, reality is more important than ideas. Well, you couldn't imagine either of the previous popes saying that. So he's saying the same things in different ways and with different levels of ferocity. People who are free market, red-blooded free marketeers, look at this pope and think they don't like what he's saying, and they don't like the fierceness with which he's saying it. And they suspect that, unlike previous popes, this man really kind of means it, and he has it at the top of his agenda. So he's as far as the right way are concerned, he's a dangerous character.
Well, is it possible that some of that you describe is a surprise to those cardinals who voted for him, that he's, you know, sort of created his own agenda here beyond what they might have expected?
I think that's true. Not in the area I've just described. On the area of what's called Catholic social teaching, which looks at the relationship between money and people, he's pretty much in the mainstream on that. Where the cardinals may have buyer's remorse, as they call it, they may not have anticipated how radical he was going to be in terms of this initiative he's just done on abortion. It doesn't change the church's teaching on abortion, and he still says abortion is a sin, but he says the church should show clemency and mercy to women who've had abortions because of huge pressures put upon them, and we have to understand women in this situation and welcome them into the church and forgive them rather than condemning them. Now, the church teaching hasn't changed, but the pastoral approach to the individuals is almost 180 degrees opposite from what it was. So there are a lot of more conservative figures in the church who don't like that.
You know, a lot of American Catholics, I've read statements, op-eds, editorials, essays, conversations with them, are excited by the Pope and use the word cool to describe Francis. I think it's pretty cool that he's talking about economic disparity, for instance, in the way he's presenting it. Same-sex marriage, the comments that he's made about gays.
Who am I to judge?
Yeah.
That's a very clever thing to say.
It is.
Because it's a question. It's not a statement.
Right.
Now, people are used to popes making statements. He's asking a question. He's not saying anything about the church's teaching on that matter, but he's changing the tone, and he's making gays feel more welcome in the church. And that is within the discourse of the Catholic Church, that is revolutionary. As you said at the outset, if you look at it from a secular liberal point of view, it's not revolutionary. But within the church, it's a big switch.
Okay, I get that. I appreciate that very much, Paul. I think some folks, maybe fallen off Catholics, disillusioned Catholics, those who are especially put off by the pedophilia scandal in the church and the way that was handled by the authorities in the church, may look at him and have very high expectations. And you're saying, is this a work in progress? Is there a long-term plan here for Francis? Or do you think with your book you've figured him out?
A bit of both. It is a work in progress, but I think we know which direction he's going in. If you look at the sex abuse crisis, what I reveal in the book, there's a kind of hidden secret war going on inside the Vatican, a civil war, in effect, between those who want the bishops to be held accountable and a complete change in openness and transparency. And those in the old guard who think this is all bad for the church, washing its dirty linen in public, and we'd better not to do this, there's actually, within the Vatican bureaucracy, the Curia, there is a real civil war going on this. And those who are trying to bring about change find themselves obstructed all the time. And that Francis's position on that is clearly with the reformers, although he has some reservations, I think, about the idea that priests could easily find themselves subject to false allegations. So he's not 100% in the camp of, you know, let's make everything transparent and open. But sex abuse is a very good example of the fact that there is kind of hidden resistance within the church and drag on a lot of these changes that he wants to make. And having said that about sex abuse, you could say that about lots of the areas that he's concerned about.
And Paul, one last thing with you today. What are your expectations for this trip to the U.S.? The Pope arrives in Washington, heads off to New York. What do you expect to hear from him?
Well, I expect two different things. One is, I don't know if you saw his virtual audience that he had with Catholics in four different churches and schools, which was on ABC television recently. He talked to ordinary people about their problems. He was sympathetic with them. He affirmed them. He said, be brave, stand up, God is with you. And he was encompassing and warm with them. I think that's what he's going to be like with ordinary people. He's for every meeting he's got with Congress or at the White House or at the UN, he's got a meeting with homeless people or prisoners or immigrants. And I think that you'll see with the ordinary people this great warmth and embrace. With the political classes, I think you'll see a bit of finger-wagging in a kind of gentle way and saying, look, you're running a system here which is not good for the people at the bottom, and you need to change it. So I think both sides of the Pope will come out in this visit. He'll have some hard words to say to the political elite, and he'll have some warm words to say to the ordinary people.
Paul Vallely is the author of Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. It's published by Bloomsbury. It's 496 pages, quite comprehensive look at the first 2 years of this papacy and a useful guide to understanding Pope Francis. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
A short break here on Midday. When we return, theologist David Cloutier of Mount St. Mary's University in Maryland and Fritz Bauerschmidt of Loyola University, Maryland, join us to talk about the headlines that Pope Francis has grabbed over the past few months: forgiveness for abortion, as Paul Vallely mentioned, an overhaul of the annulment process, and a call for global cooperation on environmental issues. It's Midday. Please stay with us. Hey, welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. We're talking this hour about Pope Francis ahead of his visit. 1 week from today, he arrives in the United States. He starts in Washington, D.C., goes to New York and Philadelphia. He'll meet with dignitaries, testifying or speaking to Congress, as I said, and the United Nations. Let's see. This is interesting. Pope Francis will stop by Our Lady, Queen of Angels, a private Catholic elementary school in East Harlem. And he's going to be visiting with the Catholic World Meeting of Families as well. That's on his itinerary. Also make a visit that would be considered unusual for most dignitaries, a trip to Northeast Philadelphia to go into a prison to meet with prisoners there. The last time we talked about Pope Francis on Midday, we were covering the church's discussion about, or his discussions about the family, same-sex couples, divorced couples, those living together before marriage. That was last year sometime. Today we get up to speed on the Pope's remarks on abortion, the annulment process, Europe's refugee crisis, capitalism, which he called a subtle dictatorship during a speech in Bolivia over the summer. Plus, Pope Francis will stop in Cuba before coming to the U.S., and we can talk about his role in brokering diplomatic relations between the two countries after a half-century standoff. We welcome back to Midday our two go-to guests on Pope Francis and Catholicism, David Cloutier, professor at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland. David, it's nice to have you back on the show.
Great to be here, Dan.
David is the author of several books, including Walking God's Earth, The Environment, and Catholic Faith. And the forthcoming, this is sort of an update of that, Reading, Praying, Living Pope Francis Laudato Si, right? Laudato Si, referring to this recent encyclical on the environment and global warming. Yeah, interesting, yeah. David. David is also the editor of CatholicMoralTheology.com online. And I just recently read an essay by you in Common Wheel, right?
Yeah, I'm on also the blog at Common Wheel. Yeah, on the Pope's visit.
I have something to say about that.
Oh,
ask
great.
You about that. Fritz Bauerschmidt is with us, too, professor of theology at Loyola University, Maryland, and deacon at Corpus Christi Parish in Bolton Hill here in Baltimore. He also blogs at Pray Tell. You can find links to the things I'm referring to on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Fritz, nice to have you back on the show here.
Thanks for having me back.
You know, David, I wanted to start with this question because how we talk about this pope, maybe any pope, but this pope in particular, is interesting to me. So he's coming to Washington, and the temptation I find, especially with him coming to Washington to and scheduled to speak to Congress, is to think of this pope as a head of state, which he is, right? But a head of state representing an institution that has a set of positions and policies and laws as we're used to thinking about them conventionally, right? Like on this show a lot, where we debate policies and laws and proposals and legislation and all that stuff. So all these issues that come up, I think Americans tend to look at it this way. What is the Pope's position on X? And it may seem to be one thing with this Pope, but it's really not, because of his style, because of his off-the-cuff remarks. Am I with me on that?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
and there's several examples of that.
Yes.
Where he sounds like a liberal, but actually he's not veering that far away from church doctrine.
Well, I think one of the challenges is that when he addresses Congress, he will say things about income inequality. He will say things about the environment. There's no doubt about that, about immigration. But underlying all of these things, I think Francis wants to appeal to the need for God in the modern world. That is to say, a lot of his reforms are oriented towards trying to help people restore this relationship with God. And it's not only that America is the richest country in the world, but also the spiritual practice of Americans has declined. And I suspect the Pope will say something about that as well.
Fritz, how about you? What do you expect to hear from the Pope? And to my remarks about how we look at this. I mean, it is a little bit more mysterious than that, is it not? It's not just a position paper. An encyclical isn't the equal to a position paper that the candidate for office puts out, right?
Right. Now, I mean, I imagine when he's addressing Congress, you know, you're going to get shots of Bernie Sanders nodding his head vigorously at certain points. But I think Pope Francis is willing to make common cause with whomever. Whether on the left or on the right, depending on the issue, right? But I do think that the framework within which what to us look like the political positions are placed is, for Francis, really a theological one. And I think if you don't just go on the news stories about the last encyclical, Laudato Si, but if you actually read the encyclical itself, you'll see that his views on things like climate change, on income inequality, are really embedded in a theological vision that he has. Now, that being said, he is willing to make common cause. I know in the rollout, as it were, of the encyclical, had climate scientists at the event where they were introducing the encyclical who are not Catholic, who are not Christian, but who agree with him on the pressing need to address these issues. So I think you see in Francis somebody who is very true to his own theological vision, yet is open to making common cause with people on a variety of issues.
Also, he opens the door to this idea that he's calling for change, okay? And it's not clear to me that there really is going to be change on any of these issues. Let me give you an example. September 1st story in the Washington Post about Francis and forgiveness for women who have had abortions. Okay, Pope Francis emphasizes forgiveness for women who have abortions is the headline. Listen to the lead, the opening paragraph. Pope Francis announced Tuesday he was opening a special temporary mercy window to make it easier for women who have abortions and confess to get back into the full good graces of the Roman Catholic Church, period. The move set off immediate debate over whether Francis had actually changed church practice or had said something symbolic and what that symbolism might be.
The key term in that statement you quoted, Dan, is make it easier. I think many of the changes, and they're real changes, that Pope Francis is making are not changes in doctrine or changes in teaching, but changes in practice that make it easier for people to receive mercy and forgiveness. I think he thinks a church of laws and of structures can be very off-putting to people, particularly people who are poor, outcast, alone. Mm-hmm. And he wants to reform the structures so that it's easier for them to return to the church.
You agree, Fritz?
I suspect that the average woman who goes into a confessional and confesses having had an abortion, or a doctor for performing one, or a man for paying for one, I suspect that their actual experience is not going to be all that different after this change. From what I know, the church has not been withholding mercy from those things. Now, there are certain technical matters of canon law which put abortion in a special category of sins, which also incurred an ecclesiastical penalty that only a bishop could lift. Now, for years in the U.S., priests had been given the power to lift that penalty, during the sacrament of reconciliation or confession. In other parts of the world, this might actually make a difference in practice. But I think, at least in the U.S., it's not going to make a real difference in the experience of the person in the confessional, except to this degree. I think priests hearing confessions might be prompted to think, well, when somebody comes and confesses to me this sin or any sin, am I embodying the kind of merciful presence that Francis is calling us to? Mm-hmm. And I think subtly, I mean, I know from a conversation with Archbishop Laurie that, and he has said this in public, that he has been personally challenged as a bishop by Francis as Pope, by the example of Francis. Not that Francis has called him on the phone and challenged him, but he has said publicly that Francis's papacy has made him rethink what he is supposed to be about as a bishop.
Hmm. How he behaves, how he acts, what he does with his time.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's a very interesting thing.
You know, I want to just, before I leave this statement on forgiveness for women who've had abortions, I'll go back to what David was saying earlier about making it easier, but also about the decline in the religious life of Americans in general, and Catholics specifically. A woman would have to recognize that she committed a sin and fell out of good graces with the Catholic Church in order to take the Pope up on this offer, right?
Right. Right. I think this reinforces Fritz's point about the overall theological framework of the changes that the Pope is suggesting. It's similar to the things that have been raised with annulment reform, that this assumes the larger theological framework of the Church's teaching on marriage and simply makes it easier for Catholics to return to the church if they're in an irregular state.
Keyword easier here. Again, this is on annulment. Here's the New York Times story from September 8th. This Pope does make a lot of news. Pope Francis announced new procedures on Tuesday to make it easier. He does these things on Tuesdays. To make it easier for Roman Catholics to obtain marriage annulments, a move intended to streamline a process long criticized by many Catholics as too cumbersome, complicated, and expensive. Fritz.
Yeah, and of course, I'm neither a canon lawyer, nor do I play one on television or the radio, so I would want to be cautious about what I would say. Inviting a theologian to comment on canon law is like asking a general practitioner to perform brain surgery.
I know it's complex.
But I think there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, one is this streamlining and this creation of what some are calling the fast-track annulment, meaning that when in the marriage there are certain criteria that are met, the annulment process can be made into a much briefer process with less intensive investigation, and that these, if you will, fast-track annulments would be handled by the bishop. So there's that aspect. I think the other thing that is interesting is the how much more is put on the local bishop. And this is a persistent theme in Francis's papacy, is this, and your previous guest mentioned this decentralizing of the church. I think in some ways, if we want to talk about radical change in the church, this decentralization that Francis is consistently doing is something that is, at least potentially, could be quite radical. I mean, you see it in the annulment procedures, a decentralizing move. You can see it in the last encyclical. One of the things that's really interesting is how many, I mean, he quotes his two predecessors, John Paul II and Benedict, in particular, he quotes them a lot, and that's typical. In an encyclical, you, of course, quote other popes. But he also quotes a lot of national bishops' conferences. And if you go through and count up the citations, he cites them almost as much as he cites previous popes.
And the significance of that?
Well, what I think he's saying is, if we want to know how the church should think about the environment and the impact that it has on people's lives, we've got to be listening to what church leaders in Bolivia are saying. We need to be listening to what church leaders in Australia, in the Philippines, are saying. We can't simply presume that Rome knows everything.
Mm-hmm. I get you.
Right. And the quotes in that encyclical are from both third world and first world contexts. He's very careful about that.
Here's a question for our listeners I'd like to put out at this point and mention our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Does Francis speak to you at all, whether you're Catholic, Christian or not, to return to a more spiritual life, to return to your church or whatever it is, your place of worship, to take part in its rituals again? Has any of that happened as a result of watching and listening to this particular pope? I'd like to hear from you. 410-662-8780. Now, this is a question I asked Paul Vallely, author of this book on Pope Francis, updated version of an earlier biography. Buyer's remorse. Did the cardinals who voted for this cardinal to become pope get more than they expected? Is this a real? Has he flipped things upside down? What are your speculations and thoughts on that?
Well, I think by and large, if you look at American cardinals who were in the conclave, they've been highly supportive of Pope Francis, and many church leaders, as Fritz mentioned, Archbishop Lurie, are feeling personally challenged and actually changing some of their style. Right, which I think is a great thing. So I don't sense the buyer's remorse. If you go on the blogosphere, there will be conservative blogs where there's a lot of anxiety about these things and a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
But I think the public face of the church, the hierarchy, the bishops, Mount St. Mary's has a seminary that has a conservative reputation. They all want to be on board with Francis. They don't want to be left behind.
Yeah, I suspect that The cardinals who were upset with the pope did not vote for him in the conclave to begin with. I think they knew what they were getting. I do think I suspect some bishops, like a number of priests, Francis makes them nervous. Right? He's not that easy to stage manage. Right.
No.
He's likely to go off script. He's
right.
Likely to, you know, to go off the farm. Right.
Right.
And I think in an organization like the Roman Catholic Church, that makes people nervous.
Does it make people, it's upsetting to some people to see a pope more human? You know,
I think they're just worried that he's going to say something that is.
I understand the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Is, but there are some people who want to, you know, they've been taught to think of the pope as being, you know, the vicar of Christ next to God and godly in ways, but not as human. He seems to have humanized the papacy. Yeah.
Many people have a temperament that they want control. And in our culture, that temperament is usually associated with a conservative mindset that they want. Not always, but usually associated with a conservative mindset. And I think the anxiety that people have is that Francis is not easy to control. And he's not particularly anxious about control. So he's not particularly worried that he will be misinterpreted if he's saying what he believes is the spirit of the gospel. He's just not worried about it.
David Cloutier from Mount St. Mary's University and Fritz Bauerschmidt from Loyola University, Maryland, our guests in this hour of midday. If you'd like to join us with a comment or question about Pope Francis, who's coming to the U.S. a week from today, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And you can send a comment by email to midday@wypr.org. Another headline. Pope calls on Europe's Catholics to take in refugees. I think we're going to hear, I would bet we'd hear some of that next week when he addresses Congress. Pope's take on transgender issues, accept the body God gave you. So, there's a mixture of comments about that. Of course, Paul Vallely referred to his statement, who am I to judge? He said it's not a statement, actually. It's a question mark when it comes to gays in our society and in the Catholic Church. Another point where, you know, he said one thing, but he's not really changing church doctrine or teaching on that, right, David?
Right, right. There's no signs that he will change teaching on issues like same-sex marriage. Again, he wants a more compassionate approach to it. We're all sinners. I mean, you could say over and over again, we're all sinners, not mm-hmm. just some people, and capture Francis.
So he's trying to open doors and windows here, right?
Yeah.
He's trying to tell people it's okay. Come on back in if you want. We're not going to hit you over the head with doctrine.
Right. At the same time, I mean, I think what he said about the refugee crisis in Europe was really interesting. He didn't say simply, oh, the Vatican's going to give however many million dollars to refugees. He, in a sense, and this I think is part of the decentralization, he put it back on Catholics. He said, I would like every Catholic parish, every Catholic monastery, every Catholic convent to take in one refugee. So in a way it's about mercy, it's about welcome, but it's also about challenge, right? Mm-hmm. He's really challenging Catholics to say, you know, put your money where your mouth is, and that this has got to happen out on the peripheries, not, it can't just happen in the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And it is happening.
You know what? You said put your money where your mouth is. It's actually put action where you would normally write a check, maybe.
Right, right.
Or actually do something.
Yeah, at Mass this past Sunday, we read from the letter of James where he says, you know, faith without works is dead. You can say to the poor person, be warm, be well fed, have a great day. But if you're not doing anything, what's that worth?
Right. That's Fritz Bauerschmidt from Loyola University, Maryland, and also David Cloutier with us in the studio here at WYPR. From Mount St. Mary's University, we're talking about Pope Francis, a man who makes a lot of news. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join us. Did you get a ticket for the Pope's visit to Washington next week? What he's doing besides addressing Congress? There's a day of meeting dignitaries and photo opportunities. Do we know?
Well, he on the 23rd, he's celebrating Mass outside a Catholic university, and this is going to be a first for the United States. It's going to be a canonization mass. Father Junipero Serra, who was a Franciscan missionary in California, is going to be canonized. He's going to be declared a saint. And again, this is part of Francis's decentralization. Canonizations used to all take place in Rome. He says, well, wouldn't it be a lot, rather than having all these people from America fly to Rome for a canonization, why didn't just one pope fly to America to perform the canonization ceremony?
Right. And I'll drive myself from the airport to the canonization.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. In my Ford Fiesta.
Here's Dana in Crofton with a comment about annulments in the Catholic Church. Hi, Dana.
Hello. I just wanted to comment that my husband and I were both previously married outside of the Catholic Church, and we both were baptized Catholic and raised Catholic, and we both, when we got together, we We married in the Catholic Church, and we didn't have to go through a lengthy process in getting our annulment and moving forward with getting married. We did have a lot of family and friends who were Catholic who thought the process was going to be more rigorous than it was. And people who had been married and divorced as Catholics and remarried at other churches even, and were scared years ago to go to the Catholic Church and see about going through the process. They were giving us misinformation that we found was just, it wasn't the case for us. And I think that it's important to not just take what people have said about what has happened in the past, but to find out for yourself and give it a chance. And I'm really very thankful that we were able to be married in the Catholic Church. And we go to church every Sunday. So
okay, Dana, thank you for your comments about your experience with annulment. I guess it's not the same everywhere, maybe?
Yeah.
David?
That's great to hear that Dana had a good experience. And I know many archdioceses are aiming at giving people a good experience. This process is much more onerous in some other places in the world. And of course, the Pope is speaking to the whole world. There are also different types of annulments already. There is actually a fast track process that some people are able to go through, but not others. Explaining this on the radio would be dangerous, as Fritz pointed out,
yeah,
because we don't want to give people misconceptions. But there are people in your local parish and in the diocese who are there to talk to you and help you through this process. So already, I think it's a more pastoral process than some people realize.
The process changes. The new rules take effect December 8th and are expected to speed up cases in which neither spouse is contesting the annulment. The fast-track cases may be heard as soon as 30 days after a couple files an application, and at most within 45 days. Again, according to the New York Times story about the Pope's announcement on annulments.
Yeah, you know, one misconception about annulments, of course, is that they're the Catholic version of divorce, right? But, of course, it's not. It's a process of investigation by the Church to determine whether there was a marriage to begin with, as the Catholic Church understands marriage, right? A lifelong bond between a man and a woman. So in some ways, it's more like a diagnostic procedure, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what Francis is doing is, like any good doctor, we can think of him as like a doctor of souls. He's trying to make sure that the diagnostic procedure is not more traumatic than the illness, right? And so I think
that's good, Fritz. Yeah,
I think in some ways what these reforms are at least intended to do is to try and make people who are in many cases already very emotionally fragile not have the church's investigation of the conditions of their marriage be more traumatic to them than it needs to be.
Let's take another call here. Dan in Baltimore joining us here on Midday. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. What did you want to say, Dan?
I just had a question, and that is, I guess I would see that Republican or right-wing politicians tend to accentuate faith, their faith and how it informs their politics and the legislation that they oppose and support. And so I was curious as to how you think it's going to play out when Pope Francis comes into town, especially to speak about taking care of our weakest and our poorest, and how that's going to play out politically between the Democrats and the Republicans.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, I think politically the cat is out of the bag on that. Conservatives will always say that they do want to help the poor. It's just that the way they want to help the poor is through allowing market mechanisms to produce more wealth.
Now, God helps those who help themselves.
You
something like that.
One may not like that argument, right. And they're not listening to everything Francis is saying about the structure of the market, but. I doubt the fact that he says we should help the poor. All the politicians are going to applaud for that and stand up on both sides of the aisle, right?
Right. I think where you might see some people on the American right squirming is if Francis talks about the role of the state in providing relief for the poor. I mean, Americans are pretty much outliers worldwide. I mean, if we compare European governments or even Latin American governments, they're much more willing to see state intervention as a and maybe the most viable means for alleviating the poor. And I think Francis very much comes out of that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's if he goes into talking about, and it would be very appropriate when talking to a governing body like Congress, when he talks about, well, what's the role of government in alleviating poverty? I think you might then begin to see some congressmen on the right, members of Congress on the right, squirming a little bit.
Yes. The more you think about it, the prospect of a pope standing in the Capitol and speaking to a joint session, it's really amazing to think about this historically and in terms of what's happening. That, you know, this the leader of the Catholic faith in the world is addressing the U.S. government's representatives, right? Our representatives in Congress. This is a really, I mean, this is unprecedented.
One can only imagine what Thomas Jefferson would have thought of this.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, some people might resent the whole idea. You know, I'm sure some people think, why are they listening to him? Why are they listening to him in this forum?
Right.
Right.
But very few religious leaders get to speak in that forum, if any, much less leaders of foreign powers that have the allegiance of, you know, a quarter of your citizenry. Right.
Yeah.
So it is a very powerful occasion. I have to say, I think he will say a considerable amount about the environment. The Paris talks, I think, are in November. The United States is a major stumbling block for the kind of international agreement that the Pope explicitly calls for in Laudato Si in his encyclical. And I think both at Congress and in the UN, he will speak pretty forcefully about the need to come to an international agreement about carbon emissions.
That's something that you think distinguishes him certainly from Benedict and from John Paul II in emphasis and the force of his rhetoric. Would you agree with that? And on these issues, because I know that Pope John Paul II, I heard him many times speak about the responsibility of the wealthy for the poor, but I guess it's emphasis and the force of the rhetoric.
Yes, the force of the rhetoric and the fact that he is Francis is actively trying to shift the message away from a judgment about certain sins in Western societies, again, the ones that we've talked about, abortion, same-sex marriage. He is actively trying not to minimize the church's teachings, but to shift the rhetoric away from the condemnation of those things. And it's certainly the case that John Paul and Benedict would always, in major addresses, speak forcefully about those things. And the Pope tends to spend much more time speaking about income inequality.
Right. It's interesting also to think about the different geopolitical situation that Francis faces than, say, John Paul II. I mean, I think a lot of people's memories of John Paul II were from the last 10 years of his papacy, where he was old and ill. And forget the first 15 years of his papacy, where he was extraordinarily forceful, but he was speaking in a world that was still the world of the Cold War.
Right.
Right. And he, I think, very much saw the United States as an important ally, in a sense, in the struggle, as particularly for him as an Eastern European, the struggle against the Soviet Union.
Liberating people.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think of some of the things John Paul II said in his first visit to Poland and the support he gave to the Solidarity movement, I mean, he was extraordinarily forceful there. But times have changed, and the role of the United States in the world has changed. And I think Francis is going to be much more willing, in a sense, to challenge the United States to step up to the plate on what Francis perceives as at least one of the major challenges that the world community is facing, namely the environment.
Well, certainly an interesting week coming up. I thank you both for being here today. Fritz Bauerschmidt, who was just speaking from Loyola University, Maryland, who blogs at Pray Tell. You can find a link to Fritz's blog on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. He also serves as a deacon at Corpus Christi Parish here in Baltimore. And David Cloutier, nice to have you back on the show again from Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, where he is a professor of theology, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I hope so. I called you a theologist earlier. And David, so you have the new book coming out this year.
Yes, Reading, Praying, Living, Laudato Si.
On the Pope's encyclical. Thank you very much. And please enjoy lunch today. We have lunch today for our guests from Cipriani's in Little Italy. In business since 1940, Cipriani's serves soup, salad, famous salad, pizza, seafood, and pasta dishes available for dine-in, carry-out, or catering. Cipriani's at 237 South High Street in Little Italy.